Drones. Eventually, they may be flying all over the place. Even though the FAA is saying to Amazon, hey, you're not going to use drones to deliver packages. That's not going to happen. But what else will they be used for? Up next, Linda Moulton Howe joins us with more on dragonfly drone that was spotted outside of a bedroom. What the heck is that all about? And welcome back to Coast, Linda Moulton Howe with us. Linda, you reported on that dragonfly drone years ago, didn't you?
2007.
Yep.
It started, it was Lex at Coast and me at Earth Files, and we received the, it was documents from a man calling himself Isaac. And I began reporting at my news website, earthfiles.com, about photographs and encounters of eyewitnesses with these strange silent craft that look a little bit like dragonflies because they're round, they have wires going up, and they have these long tails. And some of them have been reported flickering in and out of invisibility and rotating silently in the air. Very, very odd. Two different people, one in Central California and another in Birmingham, Alabama, photographed a silver ring with a long tail hovering close to power and telephone poles. That was something that people had noted. And in addition to the long arm or tail extending from that main sort of ring body, most eyewitnesses in the photo show long, thin wires that do project upward from the ring. And in three different California incidents, the photographs have showed dark blue symbols on the underside of long silver tails. And in one big case, there were boxes on the side also that had diagrams and symbols. So it was between May 2007 and now June 2014, I have produced at least 26 Earth Files news reports about these so-called dragonfly drones. And they do not seem to have pilots on board. They definitely fall into the category of drones, self-activating software drones. A most recent report was July 2013 from Las Vegas. There was a man who wrote me and sent a drawing that he saw this long-tailed silver ring, had the wires projecting upward, was hovering near the top of a tree about 60 feet from where he was standing when suddenly it shot straight out right at his eyes, an intense blue beam of light, and he felt like he had been scanned by whatever it was. And there were, at least two dozen reports in 2007, and the oldest that came to me went back to 1987 in Louisiana. But now another eyewitness has come forward to say how shocked she was at seeing a large ring with long tail, thin wires rising from the ring right above a telephone pole outside her bedroom window in Phoenix, Arizona. And the year was 1981, January, February, or March. On top of that, earliest date so far for an eyewitness of these strange things, she thinks that object was black with white symbols on the tail, not silver and blue. This 1981 witness has asked me to call her Mary. She's now 56 years old. She was born and raised in Detroit, Michigan, and studied architecture and interior design in college. And by age 23 in 1981, Mary and her then husband had moved to Phoenix, Arizona. She and her husband shared a townhouse on Black Canyon Highway with her mom and stepfather. One late afternoon in early 1981, around 5 o'clock, Mary and her family were playing cards after an early dinner when Mary's mom asked her to get some cigarettes from an upstairs bedroom dresser. Here now from Detroit, Michigan, is Mary.
So I went upstairs to get the pack of cigarettes out of the carton that was in the top drawer of her dresser. And as I was closing the drawer, I saw a shadow from the window go across the bed. It was quite a large shadow. And outside the bedroom window, not far from where I was standing, was a large object in the sky. I would say it was maybe 10, 15 feet above the telephone pole and maybe 30 feet from where I was standing at the window. The object was round with a like an arm on it, and it had wires sticking out of it. And I think I was so mesmerized by this thing that was there. I mean, it was so huge, and it was just there that I just stared at it. It just didn't make any sense to me because it was just there in the sky. And then I remembered that my camera was sitting on top of her dresser. So I quickly grabbed it and leaned out the window because in Arizona, you didn't have screens on the windows. There are no bugs. And so I leaned out the window, took a picture of it, and then ran downstairs telling my mother and her husband and my husband, go get the film developed immediately because I had just seen this thing outside. Well, of course, they all ran back up the stairs and looked out the window and the object was gone.
The fact that the shadow was big going across your bed, the object was very close to your window blocking the sun.
Yeah.
How big do you think it was in comparison to, let's say, the telephone pole?
I would say between 15 and 20 feet.
Okay, that's the circle part. And then the tail went off further.
Yeah, and the tail was quite a bit longer, as long as a car or two.
So the whole thing would have been at least 40 to 50 feet long.
It was big enough that I thought, how is it just sitting there in the sky?
Right.
What the heck is it? Why isn't it making any noise?
This is like the Rajman photos that have shown this dragonfly drone in the 2007 time period, so close to a telephone pole in the Rajman photos.
Yes. So we had the camera developed. The one picture I kept in a file for years.
Did you see any symbols?
I did see the symbols. I remember something that was black with lighter colored symbols on it.
Now, black is a different color than the color of the Rajman or the Chad or the other photographs.
Right.
When is the next time from early 1981 that you saw that photo again?
It was 1992.
11 years after her dragonfly drone encounter in Phoenix, Mary was back in Detroit. That summer of 1992, Mary was with her 12-year-old daughter and 16-year-old stepdaughter. The three were driving on Argentine Road in Heartland, Michigan, near Detroit. The girls yelled out there was something in the sky.
And both of them said, stop the car. And above the trees was an unbelievably large silver disc. And if we're going to compare that to one of the dragonfly drones, it was at least 50 to 100 times bigger than that dragonfly drone. I mean, this thing had to be a quarter mile long, just ungodly huge, and it was a silver disc. I would say we watched it for 2-3 minutes. And then it suddenly, without making a noise, just zipped off to the north, just and it was gone. So we jumped in the car and floored it. About 10 miles down the road, almost to Silver Lake Road, we had to slow down because we saw a bunch of people standing in the middle of the road. There was about 50 people standing there. And so we got out of the car, and this silver disc was now in the same place above the trees on the same side of the road. Now we have joined this big group of people standing here looking at this. I saw a man with a walkie-talkie. And I walked over to him and I said, how long have you been watching this thing? He said, we've been watching it for about an hour. I have a walkie-talkie here, and there's another man with a walkie-talkie 10 miles south of here at M59. We've been watching this thing and timing it so that when he sees it hit M59, he'll call me and tell me he saw it. And then when it takes off and it comes back here, I tell him when I saw it. If our measurements are correct, this thing is going about 4,000 miles an hour.
Or is just popping in and out from point to point?
I don't know. I just know what the man told me.
Right.
Apparently, they had been watching it go back and forth for an hour, these 50 people.
Who are these 50 people?
Well, there was police officers standing there. There were farmers standing there. There were travelers from the road standing there. There were neighbors standing there. I went home told my husband what we had seen, wished I'd had a camera. Then I called the news. I called Channel 2, which is Fox 2 Detroit, and told them that there was 50 people standing in Argentine Road and they might want to get a reporter out there because this was a big story. They thanked me for my information, and I waited for it to show up on the news that night, and it didn't. So I called the local police department and said, why haven't I seen anything about this big disc out there? Because I know there was at least two police officers standing there because the cars were there and they were there. And they said, thank you very much for the information. We'll pass it along. That's the answer I got from anybody I talked to. I never saw it on the news. I never saw it in the paper. I never heard about it again. And so I was so mad that the powers that had the opportunity to tell people about this, I contacted MUFON and said, were you aware that this thing was on Argentine Road? They said, no, we weren't. We would like to hear your story. So they did a phone interview with me. I told him about the silver disc, and then I also happened to mention to him about this photo that I had somewhere of this circle with the wires on it. And they asked me if I could send them a copy of the photo, and I said, if I can find it. I did find the photograph. I scanned it on the computer and sent it to MUFON. I assumed MUFON knew this gentleman, Isaac, because about 3 weeks to a month later, I get an email from a gentleman named Isaac who tells me that the thing you saw out on Argentine Road and the thing that you saw with the wires and the boom was most likely made right here in the United States. The story that he told me by email, and he said, you won't hear from me again. I'm going to tell you this one story, and then you won't even be able to contact me after this. He said that he was with a bunch of other scientists in the Silicon Valley, were given a technology, and they weren't told where the technology came from, but they were to find a commercial use for the technologies that they had. He said the item that he was given was black, metallic, and he couldn't identify the metal, and it had a symbol on it. He said this object had to be with these symbols in some electromagnetic field, and then it would bend light around itself and disappear. And he said it doesn't really disappear. It works on the rods and the cones in your eyes. He said animals can still see these things, but you can't. It just bends light around it. And I never heard from him again.
The carrot, commercial applications, research of extraterrestrial technology, that is the document that he distributed back in 2007. By then, we had photographs from Chad and from Rajman and from others. He came forward with this carrot document. In it were the photographs of alleged extraterrestrial technology from several sources, the document said. But in 1992, 11 years after your sighting in the photograph, he appears trying to convince you that the gigantic silver disc in the sky and the dragonfly from 11 years earlier are terrestrial technology. What were you doing in the summer of 1992 professionally that you would have a computer and emails?
I was a dental assistant.
The dentist had emails then?
Yes. I know that we were communicating with insurance companies, and that's where I think I thought that I scanned it. I mean, I'm pretty sure that I sent it by email to MUFON and Isaac. He identified himself. He said, I received a copy of this picture that you took. That's when he went on to explain that I'm not the only one who has seen these things and that the symbols on the side actually do something on this particular kind of metal in an electromagnetic field. But why he sent it to me, I have no idea.
It's 15 years later that Isaac emerges after these various photographs of the Dragonfly drones started in May of 2007. So in 1992, he wasn't leveling with you like he did in 2007, that these machines in the sky, he said in his communications and in the document in 2007, that these are machines that have been in the sky for decades and that they have the ability to be invisible and the technology is extraterrestrial and the symbols are self-activating software by extraterrestrials.
Wow. The way he described it was they bend light around themselves and that makes them disappear. And how is it that so many people see them and yet we don't know any more about it as citizens than we did back 150 years ago? Yet I can figure out that something's going on that I'm not being told. And it just makes you wonder why only a certain group of people get this information. Why don't we get this information? We live here too.
Boy, I think that all of us can relate to her saying that. We live here too, so why are we not being told what exactly is in our skies, our seas, the lands, the sounds, the objects? And if any viewer or listener has any firsthand information about this dragonfly drone technology that, according to Isaac, who said he was a scientist working in Palo Alto in the 80s, and that they were given extraterrestrial technology. There was no question about that to try to back engineer. The question is, what's up in our skies now? What are the ones that flicker in and out? And one of the most important parts about the 1981 sighting, her having the communication with Isaac in 92, and his stressing with her that these objects could bend light around themselves and become invisible, and his document that he released in 2007 that Lex got at Coast and I got at Earth Files, was stressing that when you look at the photographs, of which I have reprinted all of the material that came from Isaac at Earth Files in the report tonight, so you can see all of the photographs of these extraterrestrial technologies, including one in which one of the objects is in a field and is generating some way the ability to neutralize the gravity on these I-beams. They are literally lifted up by this object in the photo, according to Isaac, and that it is the symbols that are the self-activating software. And when they're in a field that Mary had been told by Isaac was something in the electromagnetic spectrum, that it would automatically activate these objects. They would be self-activating software, self-activating extraterrestrial technology with the ability to generate invisibility, three-dimensional holograms that the retina of the eye could not tell from the world around us, and to neutralize gravity. And even though it was 1981, she saw it, and she didn't talk with Isaac till 92, and the rest of us did not see anything about this till 2007, it's fascinating to me that this man, Isaac, has been reaching out, trying to communicate in his own way about material that he was exposed to, apparently, has found it to be worth talking to people about. But we still have a question, and Mary has been trying to find out an answer. What is the link between Michigan MUFON and Isaac? And if Isaac's out there listening and can send me an email, I would love to hear from him again.
What a great story.
Yeah, it is. And it continues to be, because we clearly are moving into this 21st century where we're going to have drones in the sky, whether they're invisible or not. And remember, in 2007, it was very clear that in Big Basin, as this big drone was flickering in and out of visibility and invisibility, Isaac stressed in his communications that was probably related to us learning how to jam a frequency that would make the extraterrestrial technology visible.
And up next, of course, a little UFO twist on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Linda. We call it Conversations with Linda, where questions, of course, perhaps you're a whistleblower or you just want to comment on a specific story or topic that she has handled. Up next, a little UFO twist for you on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Linda. So this story kind of goes back a ways, doesn't it?
Well, I wasn't sure what you meant, UFO twist.
You'll find out when you play your story.
Well, what are you going to do?
Well, no, I'm not going to do anything to you.
Well, this goes back at least to May a year ago. And I was participating as an investigative journalist in the citizen hearing in the National Press Club in Washington. And I was there to speak before a panel of retired congressional representatives who had been paid to listen to forensic evidence mm-hmm. and human eyewitness testimonies. And
we had Steve Bassett on last night, as a matter of fact.
Well,
he did a great job with that.
He had organized that. And I and many others were talking about, from our point of view, what we have been exposed to is the truth that extraterrestrial biological entities are interacting with this planet, have been for a very long time, and secret agencies of our government know it and monitor them and probably interact with them. Now, one of the videos presented at the hearing was of a man called Anonymous, who worked for the CIA between 1956 and 1960 on extraterrestrial research. He also taught cryptography at a Southeastern Army base, and that was sort of his cover. He had asked me to call him Cooper, but I know him by his real name from 16 years ago when I interviewed him on a dozen audio.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I'm always coping with allergies.
Froggy, you're going to have to do a story on frogs now.
Oh, boy. And I interviewed him on a dozen audio tapes in May to June of 1998.
Go get yourself some water or something. You have it next to you?
Yeah. Okay, now I think I'm better.
Go ahead and do that.
Sorry. Audio tapes in May to June 1998, and this was at his home in Florida. He was ill with diabetes, and he wanted to tell what he knew before passing, and he even agreed while I was there that I could return in a month to videotape everything while his memory was still clear. But soon after I left, he was twice approached by government agents threatening his son if he ever talked with me again. Eventually, I produced a 20-part series of reports at Earth Files where I called him Stein, and that's why there have been these three names, Anonymous, Cooper, and Stein. Well, a couple of months ago, in my April 2014 Coast and Dreamland broadcast and in my Earth Files, I shared some excerpts from my 1998 recorded interview with Cooper about a trip that he took with his CIA boss in August of 1958 out to Area 51, where they were introduced to a real, live, gray being. And that is also where they saw, inside of Papoose Mountain, a whole bunch of different disks that included World War II German Vril disks like the Hanabu 2, and these were in the same underground hangar with other disks that were identified as extraterrestrial by the Colonel Jim that took them around through this facility. Now, tonight, I would like to share some more excerpts from my 1998 interview with him. And this is going a few months past their trip out to Area 51 in August of 58. This is going to the spring of 59. When Cooper and his boss, Anthony, were asked to brief President Dwight Eisenhower and Vice President Richard Nixon in the nation's capital. And here now is 1950s U.S. cryptographer and CIA analyst, now known as Anonymous Cooper Stein.
This is at the meeting in Washington, D.C., with President Eisenhower, and Nixon was in on the meeting. And I told President Eisenhower at the time when we showed the various shots that we had that this looked like a German Honda V2, and he said, I think you're right.
At that point, when he said, I think you're right, did he elaborate on this whole issue of what was German and what was not in terms of the discs?
No, he didn't. He just agreed with me that that looked like a Honda View 2, and he said, yes, it was. So he had to be familiar with the different types of crafts just from looking at pictures, you know. I always had the feeling that Eisenhower knew more than we knew and that he knew a lot more than what Nixon knew. Nixon wasn't completely in the loop on this thing because Nixon was always frustrated that he was on the outside looking in.
What time of day did you travel and what was the process?
Yeah, same way we flew up to Washington, D.C., see the airport. The limo picked us up, took us to a hotel, stayed overnight. We were told to go to the Capitol building and that we'd have a meeting in the Capitol building with Eisenhower and Nixon and some other CIA officials from Langland. So we waited in this rotunda, and pretty soon a guard came up to us, and he says, I've gotten a call that they had called and changed the location. And we had the meeting with Nixon and Eisenhower at a meeting room in the FBI building. In that last meeting, we had a few FBI officials that came to the meeting that were involved with the project. No Air Force. They'd already talked to the Air Force and all the other Air Force the week before. So we had to get back in the limo and go over there.
Near the White House?
Not too far away, no.
And so you drove from the Capitol?
To the FBI headquarters, and they ushered us into the meeting room. It was about the third or fourth floor. We went in, and Eisenhower and Nixon were already there. So he got our information.
How many people, and where is Nixon, and where is Eisenhower?
When we came in, the room was well lit. It was like a conference room in the FBI headquarters building, and Eisenhower was there and Nixon was there, both sitting down already at the table. They were discussing some type of paperwork, and the FBI people came in right behind us, three of them.
Was J. Edgar Hoover with it?
No, he was not there.
Eisenhower and Nixon are sitting there talking about paperwork. What happened?
Eisenhower, he asked the FBI people, do you have much material? And they said that they had a reasonably good stack to go over. And they asked us what we had, and we said that we really didn't have much. At that time, we probably had 10 or a dozen cases to cover. And he said, we're taking you first. Come forward and show us what you have. So we brought the suitcase up.
It's Anthony and you, only
yes.
From the CIA?
Yes. And we opened it up, laid it down on the floor, and took out the big folder we had everything in it, and then laid out all the photographs. And that's when the first photograph I showed him was the Argentine one. And I said, this looks like a Hamburg Vue 2 German craft. And Eisenhower said, I think you're right. And that's when Nixon looked at Eisenhower, looked at me, and just sort of looked totally stunned. So I have a feeling that Eisenhower kept Nixon out of the loop. When I mentioned the German craft, Eisenhower did not question it. So he already had known about the German space program, who knows how long before.
Did Anthony say anything?
Anthony said, yes, I agree. This resembles the German crafts from Argentina.
And Eisenhower doesn't pick up on this and talk about, do we know anything more?
The only thing he said was, we have chips down in the area. The CIA have any knowledge about how many of these crafts are being reported coming out of Argentina? And then we gave them that report that we had gotten, that our naval vessels had radar screen contacts of saucers coming in from outer space and going into around the crest to the South Polar regions and also coming in and down into the Argentine area.
This is Eisenhower saying it.
That was part of a report that we had radar contacts.
When you said that?
Eisenhower says, that is to be expected. We expected this. It's something he was already familiar with. He may have gotten a report from CIA headquarters on something like that when it first came out.
Or from the National Security Council,
yeah.
From the Majestic 12 people.
Yeah, or anything that came that was reported. Always mention Majestic 12.
Did Eisenhower ever reference Majestic 12?
Yes. At one time, we were looking at the different photographs, and he mentioned he had told Nixon, he said, "This looks familiar. It was an aerial shot over the Netherlands," he said. "Contact Majestic on this," he said. "Verify if this is the very same thing that they had sent 3 months ago."
And did Nixon respond?
Yeah, he said, "Okay, I'll do this."
Did anybody ever explain why Majestic, why the term Majestic?
We knew it was a term for the original people that were digging into the flying saucer episodes.
It sounds like there were parallel tracks of intelligence and that Majestic would have been working through the NSC. Yeah. CIA would have been doing its intelligence, the FBI doing its intelligence,
yeah.
The Army, the Air Force, the Navy, and that all these parallel tracks and sometimes investigating each other. And I know that Navy has tried to get into CIA files. I've talked with a man who said how hard they tried and how they were blocked. Did Eisenhower in that meeting say anything about an understanding about whether or not he was perceiving that there was ally or threat or any interpretation?
No. In fact, Nixon said that Eisenhower had just told him that we're not gaining enough ground on this thing, that we need new blood, especially the Air Force.
Did Eisenhower in this meeting in the spring of 1959, is that when he said that he didn't understand why no one was getting to the bottom?
That was a quote I had mentioned earlier, that it was Nixon that said Ike is really disappointed in this thing, and that he said that we need new blood involved in this thing to try to move it along because we're not really accomplishing that much. And he said that was Ike's word. And then when he walked out, the Air Force colonel had said to us, "Boy, it looks like I'm out of a job."
Is Eisenhower saying anything with impatience, with anger, with anything that would give insight that he had any sense of whether there was hostility, any interpretation given at that meeting about these craft and these beings?
The only thing he asked us is, "Do you have any pictures with aliens similar to what you had before and everything?" And we told him, no, that we did not have anything with aliens. I think we sat there about 15 minutes with him. He looked at all of them, and we told him that all the interviews that we had overseas with people that had taken the pictures, we had this one picture we showed him that was from Holland where this thing hovered over this little town area.
Triangle.
No, that was the round one. And that it eventually when it started going up and then just darted and shot away at high speed. But he mentioned alien saucer.
There has been a story that has floated for years that Eisenhower went to see one of the live beings in California and that it was covered on his daily travel schedule as going to a dentist, but that he actually went to see a being somewhere in China Lake.
I never saw anything like that, any material like that, or any word during the meeting we had. Nothing like that was ever brought up, that he had seen an alien or spoke with an alien, whatever he might have done.
Did Nixon say anything specifically at that meeting in April?
No, very, very little. He said, "In your FBI report, is there anything unusual in that that would be interesting to CIA as far as looking for unusual type of crafts overseas?" And then they told us that they had a lot of sightings. They said, "We have some abductions. We have..."
They said that? The
yes.
FBI?
Yes.
They said they...
We're investigating two abductions that people claim that they were up in a saucer and came back. They had a neighbor that had taken a picture of the craft, and this one woman was abducted. So it tied together with two people. They said it's probably accurate. Then they said, "But outside of that, we have some more cattle mutilations."
Did Eisenhower ask any questions about mutilations and abductions?
No. So he's very familiar with that, apparently. Nixon or the president didn't seem like surprised.
And the question is, what did they know about who, what, why?
I had a feeling that Eisenhower knew a lot more, and that Nixon kind of knew the basics, but not in detail.
And you guys were treated only as a need to know.
Yes. And the president said, if it's foreign, he said, and something is hot, he says, call Richard, because he's handling anything on the foreign affairs bit. He said, he's my right-hand man on foreign affairs.
Did you or Auntie, when you got back to Fort, were you able to find out information about what the FBI's abduction cases were about?
We had a few, and we asked the CIA headquarters to give us a rundown on that particular case that was brought out in this meeting, but we never got it back.
In terms of any of the discussion with Nixon or anybody else in Washington about abductions, do you remember anybody making a comment of any interpretation or anything about what the abductions could mean?
Well, we had gotten paperwork earlier about an abduction, and the people, the ones that were abducted, were a bright light came in their bedroom and they floated out the windows and up into this craft, and then they were operated on or they had like a physical, and they woke up in the morning and they were back in their beds.
And that was a discussion with President Eisenhower, Vice President Nixon, Cooper, his CIA boss in the FBI wing of the Department of Justice in the spring of 1959, George.
Sounds convincing to me, doesn't he?
Well, I'm sure without any question, it all happened. And the revelation is that President Eisenhower was talking about human abductions, animal mutilations, UFOs, German discs, and all of that when he was president, because he had had the baton passed to him from Truman in World War II, and that Prime Minister Churchill and Eisenhower had talked about the whole issue of non-humans when they were together, according to some sources, in World War II. And these policies of denial were set in motion about something that I think the whole planet deserved to know the truth about. But, you know, it's fascinating to hear Cooper describe President Eisenhower in this meeting, saying that he was aware that radar was tracking discs coming from outer space into Argentina and Antarctica. And that probably means that President Eisenhower's context was the famous Operation High Jump. That's when Admiral Byrd went with, I think it was 4,000 people. It was on an expedition that left in August of 46. And it was supposed to set up a station, a science station in the Antarctica. And all kinds of weird things apparently happened. The expedition ended early in February of 1947. And one of the most interesting, this is hard credible, doesn't matter what anybody has heard about whether or not there were UFOs in Antarctica or Argentina or any of this. This was an interview that Admiral Byrd did with an international news service on Wednesday, March 5th of 1947, soon after they left Operation High Jump in the Antarctic. And this was published in the Chilean newspaper El Mercurio. And this is Admiral Richard E. Byrd, quote, warned today that the United States should adopt measures of protection against the possibility of an invasion of the country by hostile planes coming from the polar regions. The admiral explained that he was not trying to scare anyone, but the cruel reality is that in case of a new war, the United States could be attacked by planes flying over one or both poles. The statement was made as part of a recapitulation of his own polar experience in an exclusive interview with International News Service. Talking about this recently completed expedition High Jump, Byrd said that the most important result of his observations and discoveries is the potential effect that they have in relation to the security of the United States.
That's an amazing story, Linda. We're going to come back, Conversations with Linda, on Coast to Coast AM.